very happy that you get as in your mailbag. What kind of questions have you got this week from your mailbag, John?
Repeater, time out.
Boy, am I excited tonight. KC2WGB with the mailbag. Go right ahead, John. KQRIW on the tech net.
KC2WGB, tech net mailbag. Okay, Dick. Well, I have found that most of the younger guys want the proposed answer because along with that link comes information they are not privy to. So I think it's a decided fact that it has to be proposed in most cases. Okay, make it a little shorter, but at what price? Let me shut up and go on to the mailbag. Let me let it drop. Okay, we have a contributor here for questions who has sent quite a few good questions. His name is Roy. He would like to know how manufacturers, when they are developing a product, a radio, what is the criteria to choose an IF frequency? How do they go about that, and what is the legitimate criteria, and what is it in most cases? Over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
When I went looking through the attic of my grandfather's farm in Kings Park, where he had put in there an old-fashioned radio, which I think he had purchased somewhere around 1920, 1925. It was a TRF radio. It was a beautiful mahogany wooden box, about 2 feet wide, about a foot deep, and almost a foot high, with a great big wooden cover on the top. And you open up the wooden cover, and in there you saw four great big vacuum tubes. On the front panel you had three great big dials, and each one of the dials looked identical. If you wanted to tune to the AM broadcast station at 880 kilohertz, you had to set all three dials on the number 88, carefully tune them. That was a TRF radio, a tuned radio frequency radio, TRF they called it. So all the stages of amplification were on the same frequency, and that's how the radio in 1920 worked. And I think it was Mr. Armstrong. Along comes Mr. Armstrong, who invented the thing called heterodyne, superheterodyne. I think it's called superheterodyne. He invented the technique of superheterodyne. In the superheterodyne technique, you have a stage of RF amplification that goes into a mixer. The mixer has the RF going into one port, the local oscillator going into the other port, and the IF coming out of the third port. And then you got a bunch of IF amplifiers, and after that it becomes the detector, the audio amplifier, and the loudspeaker. The superheterodyne technique was an extremely good breakthrough, very nicely patented. I think the patent was heavily challenged and whatever, because everyone realized it's so valuable. What's the advantage of superheterodyne? Let me drop. You don't have to have all the stages on one frequency. Only the RF amplifier has to change its tuning, and the local oscillator has to change its tuning when you want to dial to a new frequency. All the IF stages stay fixed. The IF is at a much lower frequency where the gain comes much easier, much cheaper, and you can get much better filtering. So once you've got that IF stage properly chosen, with a good LO and a good RF amplifier in front of that mixer, your radio works a hell of a lot better. More sensitivity, better selectivity, sharper filtering, easier to get the gain. All the stages are not on the same frequency. It doesn't break into oscillation. You get all kinds of advantages. It was a huge breakthrough in its day. That was the state-of-the-art of radio in, let me pick a number, roughly 1920. Armstrong, I think, did that maybe 1925. I maybe got the wrong name, maybe got the years a little bit wrong, but it's in that vicinity. Okay, so mixing down to a lower frequency to get all those advantages is great. Now, how do you choose that frequency? Let me drop. As you choose that IF frequency lower and lower, the filtering gets better and better. The gain is cheaper and cheaper, and everything looks good with one exception. If I chose an IF frequency that's very low, I've now got the image real problem. In other words, if I chose an IF of one megacycle, just to give you an example, the radio will receive a signal that is either one megacycle or one megacycle below your local oscillator. We call one of those the image, and we call one of those the image response, and one of them the real response. Your RF RF amplifier, if it has enough filtering, can recognize the difference between the upper real frequency and the lower image frequency. And it can filter out one and reject the other, if you know what I mean. And so as you choose a IF frequency that's high enough, the filtering of the image signal, the phony signal, becomes easier and easier. As you choose an IF low enough, the gain comes easier, the filtering for the IF strip becomes easier. So it's a compromise. Real good superheterodyne design usually says that if the IF frequency is roughly one-tenth of the RF frequency, you're getting the best compromise between those extremes that I just described. Let me give you an example. If, for instance, I was trying to design a very simple receiver to listen to 100 megahertz, the 10-to-1 ratio means my IF would be at 10 megahertz. Okay? To listen to a 100 megacycle signal with a 10 megacycle IF, I'm going to use a local oscillator of either 90 megs or 110. Let me choose 110. So 110 megahertz is the local oscillator. The RF signal is at 100. The difference is 10. The mixer gives me the output difference of 10. It goes into the IF strip of 10 megs. That's the
repeater. Time out.
But once I've chosen that IF frequency of 10 megs, there's going to be a real image at 100. There's going to be an image signal at 120. The local oscillator is at 110. IF is at 10. So I get a real signal at 100 and an image, a phony signal, at 120. If there's a real signal out there at 120, like the FAA, it's going to come roaring through your receiver. Unless your RF amplifier up front can filter out the desired 100 and reject the 120. Whatever your IF frequency is, double it, and that many megacycles away, there will be an image response. If the IF is high enough, that image is far enough away that it's easy to filter. For you and I to design a filter that can pass 100 and reject 120, it's easy. If I had chosen a 1 meg IF, the local oscillator would have been at 101. I'd have a real reception of signal at 100. I have an image at 102. To build a filter that can select out the 100 and reject 102, that's hard. That's awful close. That's a small percentage away. And so without exotic techniques, you can't do that. So you see the example of how there's a most desirable IF frequency in every situation. And if for some reason you've got to have a whole lot of stages of gain and a whole lot of fancy filtering, then there's nothing stopping you from using the superheterodyne process twice, a dual conversion receiver. Let me drop. If I really want to do all of my filtering at 1 megacycle, there's nothing stopping me from having a first IF of 10 megs, local oscillator 110, RF signals at 100, beats down to an IF frequency of 10 megs, couple of stages of gain and filtering, and then you go into a second mixer that mixes the 10 megacycles down to 1 megacycle with an 11 meg local oscillator, so to speak. So by using double conversion or triple conversion, you can get the advantage of each one of the stages. But each individual stage, the usual rule of thumb, the IF should be in the vicinity of 10% of the RF frequency for the image filtering capability of reasonable filters that you can synthesize. Superheterodyne is a darn good thing to learn about. Almost every one of the receivers we use today is a superheterodyne. They've all got an IF strip, or two, or three. I believe in some modes of operation of the ICR7000 that I'm looking at right now. I think when you're up at the 1 to 2 gig region, I believe it is a 3-conversion receiver. Ain't that fancy? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. I believe you're right. I think my 7100 is a triple conversion on the upper band. Very good answer. Good question, too. A lot of people probably did not know that. I did not know that 1/10 was the average, but good information. All right, let me let it drop and go on to the next one.
W2TTT, with a follow-up on that? What you're listening to now is the man who runs the technical net of the Bauer Group in New Jersey. Hey, Gordon. And the other technical net, how are things going, Gordon? And go right ahead with your question Radio.com, and you'll find out that 10,000 people have looked up his call letters. Beautiful set of call letters. Go ahead, Gordon, K2LIW in the second half.
You hear you, Gordon.
Yeah, well, you know, thanks, Dad. yes, for those who don't know, I pattern much of the Barra TechNet on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock on 146.955 after this one. However, that was not my question. My question was, would you also talk a little bit about the upconverting receivers that you often see? Like, for instance, you know, a lot of the ICOM, just to pick one I'm real familiar with, the 756 Pro series, 746, 746 Pro, you know, go up to 60 or 70 megahertz upconvert. So that's going the other way, and it's only roughly, even at 6 meters, less than a 2-to-1. You might want to explain why that is, Dick. I know the answer, but you're going to be much more eloquent about it. So why do we upconvert on some of these modern, newfangled HF radios? K2RW2TTT. Back to lurking. Quite possibly you're mobile tonight, Gordon. And boy, you sound good. Nice and loud. You must be in the Palisades area. Nice high land, if you know what I mean. The most extreme example of upconverting I know of is the very first frequency band of many of the modern-day spectrum analyzers. If I'm building a spectrum analyzer that's going to go eventually to 3 gigs, 12 gigs, or 18 gigs, there usually is a band 1, and the first band usually goes from roughly 0 to 2 gigs. Frequency ratio-wise, that is huge. 0 gig and 0, you know, roughly a fraction of a megahertz is the lowest frequency, and 2,000 megs is the upper frequency on one single band. One single local oscillator covers all of that on the spectrum analyzer. How in the world can you choose a 10-to-1 ratio when your RF frequency ratio is more than 1,000-to-1? It's out of the question. Some very smart guy who I used to work with is one of the people who I thought invented this, I'm not sure, way back in the late 60s, of upconverting. Almost all spectrum analyzers will upconvert. They will upconvert to roughly 2.2, 2.3 gigahertz as the first IF. So in other words, when you're sweeping on that first band from 0 to 2 gigs, the local oscillator is going from 2.3 to 4.3 gigahertz. It's usually a YIG-tuned, voltage-controlled oscillator that can tune across that band, and the upconvert to roughly 2.2 gigs or 2.3 gigs. And you're about to say, why in the world did they do that? To upconvert, let me drop it. To upconvert makes the filtering more difficult, makes the amplification gain more difficult. It looks like everything's going backwards. But when you study what's going on, there's usually a 0 to 2 gig low pass filter on the front end at the RF connector. So 0 to 2 gigs is allowed to pass into that first mixer. The first mixer mixes everything it sees into a frequency 2.3 gigahertz higher. As such, the image of that is 4.6 gigahertz away. You ain't never going to see that image with that 0 to 2 gig bandpass filter in the front end. And it makes it work really beautiful as far as the first IF stage is concerned. Yes, you've got to have a bandpass filter that passes exactly 2.3 gigs, plus or minus as little as you can get. And in some cases, that's another YIG-tuned filter. In some cases, it's not. But yes, it is a YIG-tuned filter in some cases. Then there's a second stage of IF that takes a fixed frequency of 2.3 gigs, the first IF, and now converts it down to 27 megs. Roughly one-tenth, and in some cases that convert it down again to 27 megs. So up-converting solves the problem of covering so darn many octaves. The number of octaves that first band is covering, 0 to 2 gigs, is almost an infinite number of octaves. But by up-converting, all of the image problem goes away, and by the second and third stage of conversion downrange, you get back your filtering, your bandwidth selection, and all of the other desirable characteristics, the amplification. CIS filter step attenuator and so on with great accuracy, and they usually have at least 60 dB of step attenuation in the IF so that you can calibrate the screen. A modern-day spectrum analyzer, let me drop it. A modern-day spectrum analyzer, which in the early days had trouble getting 40 dB of dynamic range on the screen. Later on, they had 60 or 70, the best things that Hewlett-Packard was making in roughly 1968. And in 1969, a real wild group of guys at Airborne Instruments Laboratory decided that, hey, we're going to make the screen have 100 decibels of dynamic range, a 10 billion to 1 power ratio displayed on that screen. A bunch of crazy guys at Airborne Instruments Laboratory decided to do that in 1969. I joined that group of people. I was on that spectrum analyzer development program. And a couple of years downrange, I became the engineering manager of spectrum analyzer products. And so when the world found out it could be done using those Plessy Log IF chips that this company Plessy in England was building, you put the right assembly of those together, and what you think was the best you could do, 70 dB of dynamic range, all of a sudden you found that 100 was almost easy. And they started manufacturing that instrument, and immediately the rest of the world got on the bandwagon saying, me too, I could do that also. So once you got that up conversion, once you got that fancy frequency set up super heterodyne circuits, 100 dB of dynamic range of a logarithmic IF amplifier, and the right kind of an oscilloscope that can display that, all of a sudden you've got a spectrum analyzer that can show you super weak and super strong signals on the screen simultaneously and keep it all separate. I was there. It was fun. Over to you, Gordon, for some comments on this one. W2TTT, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. That was a very good explanation. So it's not only gain, but it's also ultimate image rejection. And that's why we do it in amateur ranges. But the 10-to-1 ratio generally doesn't apply. And that was kind of the point I wanted to tease out of there. But very nice explanation. I love the history, too. About that time, I guess you were starting to write a little bit, maybe in the early 70s, and that's when your call sign caught my eye in the journals while I was pining as to how I was going to pass the Morse code test sometime. All right, very good. Back to net, W2TTT. Thanks.
T2IS.
Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, K2LIW. You're a little bit noisy tonight, Bill, but go right ahead.
Okay, I'm transmitting from West Babylon at the moment. Hopefully this works out all right. You were mentioning to get people into ham radio, you might want to use scanners, and I'd like to recommend
You sounded very good for the first half of that QSO, Bill. And then you said you wanted to recommend as a scanner the so-and-so brand. And you must have moved your handy-talkie or whatever. You moved to a bad spot, and you faded out. So when you got right to the good piece of information, you recommend brand so-and-so scanner, you moved. Try it again, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, can you give me a signal check? How do I sound now?
Oh, lock your handy-talkie into that position and hold your breath and don't move. Go right ahead, Bill. You sound good.
Okay, this would be dongles that work with the RTL-SDR drivers. So that would include the DVB-T, Delta Victor Bravo-Tango dongles.
Okay, so as a scanner, that dongle, I presume you're adding to a computer, RTL-SDL, so brand name, model number, Delta Victor Bravo Dash Tango, is the dongle that does the scanning receiver function for you. Where do I buy it? How many dollars? And will it match almost any modern day computer? If I understand correctly, Bill, give us a couple words on how I get my hands on that thing and how much my wallet is going to be lightened in the process. Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is AC2IS. I can email you a link in more details, but basically I got mine off of Amazon.com, and you can expect it to cost $20 or less. receive only, no transmit capability, works with software-defined radio software like SDR Sharp.
Okay, you've answered the question. Roughly $20, Amazon.com's got it. Works with software-defined radio, SDR Sharp, I think you said. Will it work without that? What will the SDR Sharp software-defined radio function cost me? So, this is the front end that gives me the scanning function into my computer. What else must I add to the computer in dollars in order to make it work and do the scanning function for me, Bill? AC2IS, K2IW in the TechNet?
Nothing, Dick, but it does have some downsides.
This is AC2IS, and SDR Sharp is available as a free download. There are also other packages that you can use, like HD, SDR, and GNU Radio. I've not been able to get GNU Radio to work. HD, SDR works. SDR Sharp is giving me the best results so far. So that's zero cost for the software. The hardware itself will the dongle includes sort of an audio card built in that you're not really aware of, and brings the IF into the computer. The software does the rest.
Good answer, Bill. Lots of good information in it. So it's free download, SDR Sharp, among others. And too bad the GNU, GNU, haven't made work yet. And Eric, sounds to me like you've been there. Eric, give us a couple of words on your point of view of that kind of a scanner. Kilo Echo 2, Echo Juliet, the engineer of the local Channel 21 and Channel 13, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. Actually, that is a DVB, P, and also a DAB dongle. It's basically three chips. Interesting device. SDR Sharp is a good piece of software. It's open source. It's written by a whole bunch of people. Of course, most open source stuff is free for you to take down. But it has some problems. It is subject to overload. A little bit of feedback. Not really intended for what we're using it for, but it does a very nice job. There are a couple of different front-end chips that they use, depending upon whose you buy. There's a whole series of them. You can get them as cheap as like $12, $16. All you got to do is do a search for SDR. I use them a lot. Actually, I use it with Raspberry Pi. You can use it with a PC. You can use it with a Linux machine. There's different software for the different types of environments that you want to use it with. Let me know the drop. And that's a lot of problems because some of them will go as high as 1700 megahertz. Most of them will not go lower than, say, 50 because it wasn't intended for that. They're basically designed for television and digital audio broadcasting, all based in Europe. So, if you wanted to use it for TV, you'd have to be in Europe to be able to utilize it, or at some point in South America. But, an interesting device. The front-end chip is made by a company in Taiwan. A little bit proprietary, but you can get this spec sheet on it to see how it works. And basically, it provides INQ, which you go into the SDR Sharp software with, through your USB port. Really nice. It'll be a lot of fun. Just watch it. Don't hit it with too much signal. K2RIW, K2J.
U2NDG, comment.
KD2CMQ with a comment.
Okay, we got NDG, CMQ. We're going to get to both of you in a minute. But first, I got to get back to Eric on this one. Eric, you're in the area, it was exactly what Dennis was asking us earlier, NY2HF, of how do we get the modern-day hams involved. Every self-respecting ham these days, every self-respecting teenager these days has a palm top, a laptop, a desktop, an iPad, an iPod. And he's got a zillion computing devices, every self-respecting teenager, at his disposal. And assume now that the guy decides that, hey, I've heard this thing about ham radio. I'd like to do some scanning. I'd like to do some listening. And you, an RF savvy person, want to help out your teenager friend. And you recommend to him that he buys this PBBT dongle and combines it with his computer. And so I think you're telling me that this is a possible recommended procedure by which you can take a modern-day computer enthusiast, and they almost all are, and get them into the RF world of scanning by way of this process. That's what I think I'm hearing here, Eric. Is that roughly true? KE2EJ, is that the way you'd recommend? K2RIW and the Tech Man?
K2RIW, K2EJ, yes it is. Actually, believe it or not, the folks that sell up converters, so that way you can listen to the HF bands with these things. Particularly popular download is made by a company called Tetrac or Terra, I forget. There's a bunch of different ones. You can find them on eBay very easily. You simply do a Google search. Very inexpensive and a very simple way to get yourself going listening to RF. You just need to hook an antenna to it. Actually, I use a TV antenna at home. That works very well.
Very fine. Glad to hear that, Eric. Next person who want to make a comment on this was Neil, W2NDG. Neil, give us your comment. By the way, when I go to QIZ.com and go to W2NDG, you see a picture of Neil with his beautiful orange tabby cat, the favorite cat I ever had. Looked just like that. What's your cat's name? Oh, with you, Neil, W2NDG, K2RIW in the Tech Med.
My cat's name is Nori, N-O-R-I, although lately he's been referred to as the Paper Slayer, which I'm not going to get into, but I've given a couple of Linemark meeting talks on this dongle, and I just wanted to add to a lot of what Eric said. Everything Eric said is the case. I mean, there definitely are shortcomings to using it. I've found from sample to sample, though, it can vary, but the older dongles that you were getting off of eBay were using the Elonix E4000 chip for the tuner, which did not go below 50 megahertz, as Eric said. But the newer ones, and I forget the chipset, someone who's in front of a computer and not driving like I am could probably look it up. The newer ones go down, I think, to 25 or 26 megs. And if you want an example of how well this works, there's a guy on websdr.org. If you go to that page, it's a whole list of streaming radio that loads within a web page using Java. There's a guy in Seagirt, New Jersey, who has a six-band SDR streaming setup in a web page. Let me drop for a sec. The three top bands he's streaming in, which are 10 meters, 6 meters, and 440 currently, are all running off of these dongles. And the performance is surprisingly good from his setup. I have an older E4000 one, and I've had pretty good luck with it, and I demoed it at the meetings. I also, as Eric said, you can interface these with a Raspberry Pi. I showed how you can stream them live over the net using Raspberry Pi, which when I have mine running, I can sit at my office in Manhattan and listen to any frequency that the thing will pick up sitting at my home in Huntington. So, very handy. They can also be used to track the newer aircraft positioning system, which is something I demonstrated at the meeting also. Really interesting toy for $20, well worth the investment, and XTF is constantly growing and changing. It's a great piece of software. W2NDG, back to you, Dick.
Fantastic. Neil number one. And we'll get to Neil number two in a minute. And I got a further question for you, Neil number one, NDG, and that is when Jim asked us earlier, this is KC2ZUM was asking us about what is he going to hear on 6 meters. 6 meters is roughly 50 megacycles, but single sideband and some good sensitivity is required. If Jim wanted to take the, here we go, Al. If Al wanted to take the inexpensive approach, he doesn't want to go out and buy a real scanner yet, doesn't want to go out and buy a real 6 meter rig by Elinco or Yaesu, spend a whole lot of bucks until he's sure,
that he wants to do some scanning on 6 meters and listen to single sideband signals. Will that SDR and that dongle combination give him that capability, in your opinion? Can he tune 50 hertz at a time so that he can get the single sideband to sound good? Maybe 10 hertz. It would be nice if he could get it. So does Al have the capability, does Al have the possibility of going this approach to listen to single sideband on 6 meters? I know that's a tough one. W2NDG, K2RIW in the tech man.
Excellent question, and I've actually used it on 2 meters exactly for that, because with a waterfall display, it's excellent for spotting, and the one or two sideband contacts I've made on 2 meters, that's how I found them. I sat there and watched the waterfall display and waited for signals to come up so I could tune to those frequencies. It would work just as fine on 6 meters. Now, I have to tell you, because the guy in Seagirt, New Jersey is close enough, I watched his 10-meter signals to get an idea when 10 meters is active, when 10 meters is up, and if I see signals on his waterfall display in his webpage, I'll tune and see where they're coming from, and that gives me an idea whether or not it's worth my trying 10 meters. Since he's also streaming 6 meters, you could even forego the investment and just listen to the Seagirt, New Jersey feed on 6 meters and watch the waterfall display right in your webpage.
Well done, Neil. I'm a little bit afraid that Al said he wasn't going to be able to hang in there real long, and maybe he's not hearing what we're saying right now, but one means of another, if you guys within the sound of my voice can get this information to Al, Kilo Charlie 2, Zebra Uncle Mike, guarantee he would be very appreciative of what we just heard from Neil. And by way of the QRZ. Here we go. amateurradio.tangovictor. Eventually you'll be able to read it on that website, all of the recordings that we get from Mike Perry, KC2NJI. So it'll eventually be there for people's availability. Darn good information, Neil. Neil number 2, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Quebec. Go right ahead with your information, Neil number 2, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Actually, I was going to say the same thing that Neil just said, so I really don't have much to add, except there's a company called No Electronics, N-O-O Electronics. If you look them up on the web, they have the latest dongle and a up converter board, so you can go all the way down to the AM broadcast band if you want, between the two of them. Back to the net.
T2IS, comment?
Bill recognized. We'll get to you in a second there, Bill. Darn good information, Neil. Neil, by the way, you live in Glen Oaks, the town of Glen Oaks. This repeater, you guys are listening to the western input of this repeater, is also in Glen Oaks. So you are right in the backyard of this machine, and my guess is you don't have to put on more than a milliwatt to make a beautiful signal into this machine. Is that true, Neil number 2, KD2CMQ, K2RIW in the tech man?
If you wait 1 second, I will give you a demo.
I recognize the sound of a Luxon.
Yes, I just switched over to my Baofeng from my base station, and you probably can't hear the difference. Over.
Absolutely not. And just like you said, very little difference. And many of these commercially intended $40 type Chinese-made radios, quite a few people are a little unhappy these days that the audio, the deviation is a little bit too narrow. Yours had very normal sounding deviation. How did you do that? Is it the Model 3 instead of the Model 5, or did you buy it at an older time, like 6 months or a year ago, before they started with the super narrow band? How does yours have the right amount of deviation, Neil? KD2CM2, K2RIW in the tech man.
I've had this about a year and a half. It's actually how I got, one of the ways I got into ham radio. I bought it to listen to used the 2 meters and before I actually got my license. So it's probably a year and a half or 2 years old. Back to the net.
So that's the magic. A year and a half ago, Balfong had the right amount of bandwidth, and I think the one I'm looking at right now is a UV5RA, is the one that I've got, and it has the super narrow problem, and someday somebody's got to study the actual radio chip inside to find out what's the difference that's doing that, and if anybody's selling a used one that's a year and a half old, the problem goes away. By buying the modern one, you've got the super narrow problem, which there's various fixes on the net telling you, on the internet telling you how to fix it by making changes to the audio. In my opinion, that's not the elegant approach. So what was the model number of yours, Neil? And lucky for you, it's the older one that's got the right amount of modulation. KD2CMQ, K2LAW in the tech net.
K2IL.
Bernie recognized, but Neil first, go ahead.
On the front, it just says UV5R. I've never really looked any closer for a serial number. I'd have to take the thing apart, I guess, to look for it. Over.
Very fine, Neil. You've answered the question. Okay. We've got Bill and Bernie in that order. Bill, Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, K2LIW. Go ahead with your comment, Bill.
Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to point out that this dongle ships with an antenna that does not really work for ham radio, and in order to connect it to a better antenna, you need to get an adapter. I sent you an email already, and there's a link to that cable along with the link to the dongle.
Now, when it comes to a guy establishing an inexpensive, maybe the antenna is made out of coat hanger wire, maybe following the advice of Kent Britton, Whiskey Bravo 5, Victor Julia Bravo, WA5, Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJuliaBravo.com. You go to that website, second page, you'll find out how to build very inexpensive, very high performance, patented coat hanger type antennas. So roughly how many dollars do I have to invest to get the adapter into a better antenna to get good 6 meter or 2 meter operation with that dongle? What's your guess on that one now, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW in the tech net.
This is AC2IS. I would say maybe another $10 on top of the 20 for the SDR.
Yeah, run that by again. An extra $10 on top of the 20. Is that the price of the adapter? The price of the software? Up till now, I'm led to believe that I can get software, freeware downloaded with no dollars. So what is the extra $10 buying me? Give me a cost breakdown on that one, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW. Thank you for the info.
This is AC2IS. $20 is a high estimate for the cost of the dongle itself. The software is free, and I'm not sure if $10 is an accurate number for the cable, but I think that's a good ballpark number.
2NDG comment.
Neil recognized you can be right after Bernie. Okay, now I understand. So it's the price of the cable. So you're giving us the whole installation. The price of the cable that goes up to the antenna on the roof, as well as the adapter and so on. Let's hear what Bernie's got to say in all this before we go to Neil. Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Good evening, Dick. I was responding to your previous conversation, or previous topic of the Balfong deviation problem. You are aware that they are narrowband and wideband radios, so you do need to go in and set the deviation to be wideband or they will be weak on audio. I have both a UV5 and a UV5RC, and I have both of them set to wideband and don't seem to have that problem.
And for a person who bought the radio a year and a half ago, you're absolutely right, Bernie. And the radio that you buy today from Amazon, for instance, has on its settings a so-called narrow and wide mode. The narrow mode is around 3KC. The wide mode is around 3 kc, and the narrow mode is around 1.5 kc. It's the new commercial bandwidth settings. There's something on the front panel, commandable, called wideband and narrowband. But the widest wideband in the machine you buy today is, by my standards, 6 dB down in audio, because it's half the deviation I'd like to be. I wonder if you're aware of that, where I'm burning. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW in the TechNet. I bought two of them.
My newest unit is 3 months old, and I don't seem to have that problem. Eric put it on the scope when we got him. We picked him up in Dayton, and he didn't seem to notice anything odd on the service monitor. Next time I'm over near Eric's shop, I'll have him put this one on the service monitor to see what he sees.
Made 5 cars with a deviation. Service monitor.
Now, quite possibly the guys at Dayton were smart enough to make sure that sold to ham radio, by whatever means, had the right amount of deviation. But if I just go to Amazon today and buy the newest and latest of any of the Baofengs that I know of in the UV5 series, that all this new commercial narrowband mode is my belief. Let's see what Eric's got to say on this one. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
You know, the ones that I've seen, I've tested out, this SF5, and SF3, and SF2.5, but I understand that in software you can switch from wide to narrow, although I haven't tried it yet, but I believe there's a way to do that.
One of the 20 command functions on the front panel does have something that's called narrowband and wideband, but a significant number of people have used either the computer commanding or the front panel commanding on the most modern radio and gone to the commanded wideband mode, and they ended up with, let me pick a number, 3 kHz of deviation. Everyone complains that they're kind of quiet. So that's something to look into. It's not clear as I see it. There's a number of websites telling people that, yeah, it's going to be narrow until you make this modification, physical modification of the audio circuits to give it more gain, or drill another hole in the front panel to get a little more audio into the microphone, things like this. So these radios, when you read the manual, you realize they were intended for commercial service, not intended for ham radio service. The number 3 Baofeng, the Baofeng UV3, doesn't have the problem that I know of. All of the 5s seem to. We'll get back to that one. Let me just go over to Neil, who wants to give us some further words. W2NDG, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Neil.
It still has Phil.
I heard something at the end there. Hey, Dick, I might be a little weak into the repeater, but I'm sure I'm very strong on the input because I'm literally around the corner from you. I just wanted to mention what the connector was on the dongle. It's a PAL connector, European-style TV connector. Radio Shack sells a PAL to S adapter, which runs, I think, $3 or $4. And from S, most of us have a drawer full of connectors that'll go from F to something useful. So, a PAL connector. You can also just cut the connector off of the antenna, the useless antenna that they come with, and then solder something useful onto that. I've done both. W2NDG, back to you, Dick.
Still had another issue.
Very good information. Very recognized. Very good information, Neil, number one. Neil, number one. And by the way, you're 60/9 on my input, and you sound beautiful into the machine. You must be on my hill, so to speak, which is nearly 300 feet above sea level, in order to get that good coverage into the machine with your mobile rig. Is your mobile rig running 50 watts, Neil? W2NDG, K2LIW.
IC207 putting out about 50 watts. I am at the end of Old Country Road. I'm probably pretty weak now because this is a notorious dead spot.
A tiny bit of picket fencing. You're doing beautiful from Old Country Road. Not to worry. Okay, now with AC2IS and Bernie in that order with some further information. Now, Bill, make sure you wait for the 4 beeps. You've done a couple of doublings here. AC2IS with the 4 beeps, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Bill.
Globalsat MCX. I'm not familiar with the PAL term, and maybe the other operator is talking about a slightly different dongle than the one that I have. I'm not sure. I did email you info on both the cable and the dongle. Let me break here for a second. Another question, wondered about the practicality of using a Mylar sheet as a ground plane, like the kind of things that you can buy as a space blanket. I don't know how I would make an electrical connection to one. I don't think I could solder to it without just melting it into something useless. Wondered if anyone had any ideas on that.
Yeah, that's a tough one, Bill. But before we go over to that one, I know Bernie wanted to make a further comment, but those Mylar sheets, the actual conductor in there is so super thin, covered with plastic in order to keep it from ripping, to give it strength, and it has to cut through the insulation of that plastic, make good electrical contact, and you can't solder aluminum, particularly aluminum that's thin. You try soldering it and it just disappears. So making direct electrical contact is difficult. However, I can see a beautiful solution here. Every one of the mag mounts that we put on our automobile has a nice piece of plastic on the bottom of the magnet, making sure that the metal doesn't scratch the paint on the top of your car. The tuning of the antenna recognizes the coupling capacitor in series with the bottom of that antenna and the sheet metal of your automobile. And that tuning capacitor, that thin piece of plastic, is part of the design. So you choose the right kind of sheet metal material that you can make good contact to, the right kind of copper tape or whatever, and paste it on top of the blanket you're talking about, the Mylar sheet blanket. You'll get enough capacitive coupling that radio-wise you will be connected to that conductor of that Mylar sheet. So you don't need direct radio contact when you're working at frequencies like 144 megacycles. A few picofarad of coupling capacitor does the job beautifully. So I guarantee there's a solution there, Bill. And when you find it, please come back and let us know about it. Bernie, I know you want to make a comment. K2 Yankee Oscar, I think it was. K2LIW in the Tech Man. I thought it was Bernie. Who was the other person who wanted to make a comment? I may have written down the call letters incorrectly. K2LIW. Okay. John, I think we've only gone through one and a half of your beautiful mailbag. And boy, we get into some great subjects here. Go right on to the next one if you'd like to, John. KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick. Oh, yeah, we'll cover one more because it's getting late. We've got to get Paul in here, too. I have a question from Jay, call sign, NO2J, and he's from New Jersey. And you should have an answer for him on this one. He has a TWT Helix, which is built for 14 gigahertz, 750 watt. He wants to know if the WR75 can be made to work at 24 gig. Is that possible? He wants to use this for EME. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Wow. Answer is absolutely yes. You gotta be careful now. 750 watt TWT. Oh, he's got a beautiful piece of hardware there. Probably runs on 10,000 volts at half an ampere, or a third of an ampere going into that tube. And yes, it's a ground station TWT intended for 14 gigs. And you got to be careful. A significant number of those guys, I'm one of them, wants to move a 14 gig down to a 10 gig. The TWT, the tube itself, is perfectly happy, generating tremendous amounts of power at 10 gigs. There's a catch. The very fancy waveguide structure on the output of that tube has some fancy doodads inside that are trying to control the group delay distortion for a satellite uplink at 14 gigs. As such, that fancy tuning structure built into the waveguide, very simple looking, but it's kind of exotic. It's got the elegance of simplicity. Let me drop it. When you try to use it down at 10 gigs, and I have, it creates an almost perfect short circuit at the 10 gig amp band, 10.368 gigahertz. does a beautiful job at 14. It's almost a dead short circuit at 10 gigs. Now, will that circuit, again, give you kind of a short circuit phenomenon up at 24 gigs? It's something you've got to worry about. There's an easy way to find out. The helix of the tube itself, believe it or not, if you have direct access to the helix, by removing the piece of waveguide, go directly to the input connector or the output connector. When you make direct connection to the helix, you'll find something really magic. It is a 50-ohm distributed transmission line. The helix itself has an impedance of 50 ohms, almost DC to light. Not quite, but almost. So the tube itself, will it generate power? When you properly adjust the cathode voltage, which is called the first accelerator voltage, you have to readjust the voltage a little bit, because the way the TWT works, let me drop. It is a velocity modulator, not a bulk modulator. Your ordinary negative grid tubes, as you change the voltage on the control grid, you're changing the number of electrons that go from the cathode toward the anode of a vacuum tube. The control grid does that for you. It controls the flow, bulk adjustment of magnitude. Traveling wave tubes work by velocity modulation. As the signal goes down the helix, you have multiple wavelengths, quite often 14 wavelengths worth of signal on that helix. So you got a bunch of pluses and minus signs at each instant of time on the helix. They, in turn, are creating electrostatic attraction and repulsion to the beam of electrons that are carefully focused going down the center of the helix. And so those pluses and minuses on the helix voltage speed up and slow down the electrons in the beam, and as such they become bunched. And the bunched electrons at the tail end of the tube is the great big signal that comes out of that helix. And so you have to carefully adjust the velocity of the beam to exactly match the velocity of the signal going down the helix. When those two velocities match each other, they couple like crazy, the bunching action takes place, you get 30 or 40 decibels of gain out of the tube with 700 watts coming out, and you'll be happy as anything in the world. But now, once you recognize the tube itself is a 50-ohm transmission line, let me drop. And you can confirm that by making a directional coupler measurement at the input end of the tube. And you put in 14 gigs, and you'll see that it's very close to a 50-ohm load. You put in 24 gigs, you're most likely going to find out it's very close to a 50-ohm load on the input connector, which is usually an SMA connector. The output connector, if you backfeed your piece of WR75, and the WR75, it might be doing a little bit of multimoding, but it's going to have very low loss at 24 gigs, no problem. You can feed the signal in at 24 gigs. Will it give you an impedance match on the WR75 waveguide? You know the tube itself gives a beautiful match. You feed a signal back into that waveguide. If you see any significant amount of reflecting signal, then you must correct that right there. By the way, you're doing this measurement with the tube turned off. You've got a 50-ohm load on the input SMA connector. You're feeding a signal backwards into a dead tube, not turned on in any way, and you're just measuring standing wave ratio, reflected signal on the W75 waveguide. And you better see a very low reflection if everything's working right. If not, correct that first before you turn on the tube. If you make the mistake of not recognizing that the output connector is a very small, very poor impedance match at your new frequency, 24 gigs, if you don't correct that, then all this beautiful 700 and some odd watts the tube will be generating will be going into what it thinks is a short circuit on its output piece of waveguide. That signal will reflect back on the helix and may do damage to this tube. That tube, in my opinion, is worth a healthy 10 grand, so go easy with it. So make these measurements first before you turn it on. Correct the output impedance before you proceed. Once you can feed a 24 gig signal backwards into that waveguide and get a good impedance match, then it's time to carefully go forward, and I think you're going to be very happy. He's got a nice piece of hardware there.
Repeater, timeout.
Back to you, John. KC2WGB. And congratulate him. He's got a real good find. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay. I'm sure Jay will be happy hearing that information. He's got a little great little item there. And he doesn't have the the ability to get into the TechNet from where he is located in Jersey, but it would be very staticky. So he just emailed that over to me. So I was glad to broach that question for him. So, okay, Dick, back to you. Let's pick up Paul. It's 11 o'clock already. KC2WGB.
Hey, you get some very wide range questions there, John. We only discuss cabbages and kings. Fantastic. Okay, yeah, Paul, what's NASA doing this week? And trying to remember, what program did I see? Oh, trying to remember what program I saw which said something along the lines, it was a news program. Yes, I think it was Nightly News on PBS. Why can't I think of the name of the program? You know the one. Comes on both at 6 o'clock, Channel 21, 7 o'clock, and Channel 13. That PBS news program, one of those sessions in the last week, talked about NASA's funding and whether or not we're going to Mars and whatever, and everybody still wants to go to Mars. They want to put a human being on Mars. You guys have heard me say before, I love space travel. I love man in space. That ain't the right goal. To put a human being on Mars, I'm going to give you some beautiful information after Paul speaks that'll tell you about something you don't realize. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, KQRIW in the TechNet.
And I have a question for Paul also, Dick.
You're on the list. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, fine business. This is WS2N. Space portion of the technical net. I just wanted to bring up a couple of space launches. Nothing that new. We've talked about these upcoming launches in the past, but they are getting closer. The September launch by SpaceX in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. They're going to launch first time without the Dragon, and they're going to have the fairing on top, and inside the fairing that's going to fall away once they get out of atmosphere will be the Canadian vehicle, Cassiopeia, which will be launched at Pacific time down here from 9 to 11, but that's probably like 12 to 2 p.m. On September 5th, and they've rebuilt the launch pad for Dragon to do this, and now our East Coast, West Coast launch facility, launch capability at SpaceX. They've got a lot of other private missions on the agenda, including eventually the heavy lift, which will be equivalent to about 3 Falcon 9 rockets. Now this rocket, and I know I brought this up last week, but it's very nice engineering change. They're going from 3 rows of rockets, they call it the Falcon 9, that's where they get the 9 rockets, to 1 in the middle and then 8 around it, like in a big circle. One of the reasons for it, we'll be better control of the 8 rockets as they fade out. They're all tied into one another fuel-wise. The last one that will be going will be the center one, and that will fire when it's going around 4,000 miles an hour. After the fairing has been released and the payload has been released, including the second stage, this first stage will fire again. First time ever for something like this. And they'll start drifting back and heading towards the Pacific Ocean. And then just right before they hit the Pacific Ocean, they're going to fire it one more time. It's going to light up. And they're going to try to duplicate or simulate as best as possible a vertical landing position as they hit the ocean. They'll be doing this flight after flight, including the ones that launch from Florida. All missions in the future by SpaceX will be done like this until eventually they get better control over their rocket and they're able to land the first stage. The goal of Elon Musk for SpaceX is to